So as as one of the journalists behind the 2017 ATIP story in the New York Times, which I think many would agree represented a major transition in how the UFO subject is handled, both by the mainstream media and also the US government, you've contributed to the destigmatization of this issue. But the stigma still remains in mainstream media. It's still very present, and there are aspects of this conversation that are still considered too challenging or controversial for mainstream press to take seriously right now. And an example of such a discussion, one that you seem to have focused on lately, is the issue of UFO experiences. People who claim to have witnessed a UFO, perhaps even interacted with a non-human intelligence, some form, maybe claim to have been abducted or experimented on. Discussions on this aspect of the UFO phenomenon would still appear to be, for the most part, relegated to the confines of the UFO community itself and considered too controversial for mainstream discussion. But you've recently published a book titled The Believer: Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. So what made you decide to attempt to break through the surface of the mainstream arena with a conversation about the UFO experience and abduction phenomenon?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. I have been working on the John Mack story for about 16 years. It predated my work for the New York Times with Leslie Kane and Helene Cooper on breaking that big story on the secret Pentagon effort, secret until then, to investigate UFOs. So I had been, doing this for quite some time. The Times piece came about quite independently of anything I'd been doing on my book. But the reason I took on the book in 2004 was I became aware of John Mack. I was in Texas for the New York Times, and a copy of his second book kind of fell into my clutches quite by accident. Synchronistically, you might say. And so I'll tell you that story first. I was quite struck by the idea of a Harvard psychiatrist who was interested in the whole idea of alien encounters. And it was so counterintuitive because he was extremely highly respected at Harvard. He'd written a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on Lawrence of Arabia. He distinguished himself in so many different ways at Harvard. So I thought I'd call him up and arrange an interview. I had no idea how famous he already was. Won a Pulitzer Prize for a psychobiography of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. He had innovated in psychiatric services to the poor. He had campaigned against nuclear weapons. He had campaigned for peace in the Middle East. I guess we know how that went through no fault of his own. But anyway, he'd been involved in a lot of things, and this was quite striking. So I thought I'd call him up for an interview because it was so striking, his interest in alien encounters. And a few days later, I pick up the New York Times and find he's been run over and killed in London, looking the wrong way, which us Yanks do over there. It was a drunk driver, no, nothing nefarious. Rumors spread, understandably, that he'd been assassinated, and nothing of the like. I had checked it out very carefully, as it turned out. Anyway, so I did contact the family and eventually gained access to his archives, and that was the book. And I've been working on that for a dozen years or more. When Leslie Kane, my colleague, who I got to know through my research on John Mack, she's an investigative reporter, sort of the dean of reporters on UFOs and other anomalous events, told me that she had been down in Washington, D.C. This was October 2017, while I was working on the book. And she said she had attended a meeting in Washington with Lou Elizondo, the head of the secret Pentagon office to investigate UFOs. And we didn't know that there was such an office. We thought that the Pentagon was out of the UFO business with Project Blue Book in 1970. So he was quitting because he wasn't getting enough support, but there was this organization called ATIP, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, and it had been monitoring close encounters with UFOs. Nobody knew what they were, but they seemed to be physically real, and our Navy jets were interacting with them. So that was the story that we got into the New York Times because we had it, no anonymous sources. It was all on the record. We had Lou Elizondo's military record. We had his letter of resignation. So it was a no-brainer. And the Times, editors, to their credit, agreed it was a good story, solidly sourced, and they put it on the front page on a Sunday. That was December 2017. So that's the story how that came about.
So is it just John Mack that's influenced you to jump into this aspect of the conversation around experiences and abductions? Is he the keystone to your interest?
He is, because he was very courageous to do this. Of course, in the course of my reporting, as I said, I researched this for 16 years. I came across a lot of other figures who were instrumental, David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins and other people less well known who were pioneers in this field, including scientists who showed up at a conference at MIT in 1992 to look into this whole thing. So there were a lot of characters at play here. And courageous people in the field of science who risked their reputation. But John Mack clearly was the lead figure.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of gravitas behind someone with his type of background, taking such a keen interest. I have an idea that you'll probably mention the ones that I'm thinking of, but is there any particular cases of abductions or human interactions with UFOs or the occupants that you feel are very strong and worthy of further discussion?
Yeah, well, there were a number of cases that drew John Mack's interest early on, and that then as he became more expert in the field, that riveted his interest and remained sort of touchstones of the phenomenon today. One would be the Ariel School incident of 1994. When school children at a day school outside Harare, capital of Zimbabwe in southern Africa, children of all different backgrounds saw a craft landing during recess. 60 different children witnessed this, and two beings apparently emerged and had some interactions with the children telepathically. The children all described the encounter separately and consistently with each other. They drew pictures of it for John Mack. John Mack dropped everything at the time and rushed there with a camera crew and documented that case, which remains really one of the most interesting cases to date because it involved children who presumably were uncontaminated, by the culture. They hadn't read books about UFOs and aliens. They hadn't seen movies about them. And they were pretty innocent, and their accounts were quite consistent and compelling. So that's one case that jumped out. And another case that John Mack investigated early that I found very compelling and he found compelling was a story of two teenage girls who had a sleepover. And during the night, the mother, one of the girls, went down to check on them and the girls were missing. And she obviously panicked, called the police. They searched all over. They couldn't find the girls. And a few hours later, they turned up back in their beds. And later, the girls both said that they had had some kind of an alien encounter, that they had seen a UFO outside the window. They described, some interaction with these beings. So that case brought to light the possibility of third-party corroboration. The mother, who testified basically to John Mack that the girls were missing. And not in, in all cases, this was not true, that people have been abducted or had abduction type experiences when they were not missing. Another case that, that John Mack learned of that really was fascinating was of a woman who fainted in her husband's arms. And while he was holding her, she had the sensation of flying up into the sky, being carried, levitated, having these, you know, otherworldly encounters, and then coming back to her body. And he was holding her the whole time. So here you have the two polar opposites. One case, you know, the body missing. Another case, the body being physically there. So I don't know what you make of that, but the phenomenon is very strange.
Yeah, well, this is where this is that nexus between physics and consciousness, between, you know, the material and the immaterial that the UFO issue seems to occupy, which I find fascinating because I like to engage on both sides of that discussion. So I find it interesting that this exquisite technological marvel, which it seems to be, also seems to represent some strange transcendental consciousness related realm. And that really challenges the way that we are right now in terms of our modern scientific structures and models. It challenges us on so many different levels. And I find that very interesting.
It does. And, you know, clearly this mystery persists. What gets me are the people, the so-called, you know, skeptics and debunkers who are ready, you know, with a solution. And they say, yeah, well, they know this is sleep paralysis. Well, a lot of these incidents don't happen at night. They happen when people are driving in their cars or out by themselves, awake and about. So, you know, John Mack looked into all the possible explanations that the people were deluded or mentally unstable or mentally ill, or that they were having a nightmare, or that they were making it up for profit, you know, or publicity. And all these explanations quickly fell by the wayside because they just don't hold up. These people are not looking for attention. On the contrary, they're fleeing from it. There's no consistent pattern to the people who are encountering this. And in some cases, the young children, some cases really young children, like 2 years old, who, you know, don't even read. You know, one little kid said, "Mommy, you know, little man, take me up into the sky. I fly in the sky." And in some cases, there was fragmentary evidence, like, you know, signs of a UFO landing outside the window, broken branches or pressed down grass. And as I said, these occasional third party corroborations. And scars in some cases that people couldn't explain how they got these scars. So all, you know, it falls short of absolute proof. Obviously it does. And we don't know in what reality these things are taking place. But clearly, from John Mack's extensive research, and I've talked to some of these experiencers myself, the easy explanations, you know, don't add up.
Yeah. Well, as an experiencer myself, I have to agree, because that was, you know, the things that I was lucky enough to see are the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing still, and pushing forward with my platform and trying to learn more. So I totally respect the people that are claiming to have experiences, and I also understand the aggravation that comes with what seems to be a deliberate subjectiveness to the issue, because there's no evidence for my experiences, there's rarely evidence for other people's experiences. You have to pretty much just go on how credible they seem to you and how, you know, sane they seem to you. And that's an interesting issue with this, because I mean, I would imagine that it's deliberately done, like, for whatever reason that they're interacting. It seems to be deliberate, that they don't want you to have irrefutable evidence of it.
That's a very good point, Jay, that It is a signature hallmark of the phenomenon that it doesn't lend itself to being documented. People have set up cameras with trip wires and recording devices, and they just don't record the encounters. People emerge with fogged memories or wiped memories. Sometimes they're enhanced through, you know, hypnosis or, memory enhancing procedures like relaxation techniques, et cetera. But this phenomenon, as you say, you know better than anybody, does not lend itself to documentation. And often the experiences are the most confused. It's not like they're rushing to tell you of an experience and they know all about it. They don't understand themselves. Why they have been picked out. Why are some people, for example, I never had an encounter experience, neither did John Mack. I've never seen a UFO, neither did he. Why haven't we? It's just not, it does seem to run in families. Did you have any family history? I mean, parents, grandparents who
might
have had similar?
You know, funnily enough, I was talking to my grandma today, and one of the famous stories of the family is, it's not a UFO story, but it's a ghost story. You know, one of my auntie who lives on a farm that's been in the house for like generations. She had an experience where a woman, she was in the kitchen looking down the hallway, and a woman in what looked like Victorian dress walked past the corridor, and she saw her clear as day. And she turned and looked past my auntie said she looked past her, and as if not really recognizing that my auntie was standing there at all, and then walked straight through the wall. But she walked through the wall with the motion of opening a door. And there used to be a door there that was no longer there. Oh. And so it was like, and she's a very, you know, she's a very well-to-do and reliable kind of person. It's the only time she's ever given us a story like this. And we all believe her, but it was, me and my grandma were literally talking about this today, and we're convinced it was just some ripple in time. It seems like it was an event that did occur once, because it was almost like she was walking, looked, saw her husband and smiled, and then went through the, you know, the door that used to be there. And but no UFOs. I seem to be the outlier, unless they're not telling me something. I seem to be the outlier.
That really is interesting, because again, what gives this phenomenon such immediacy, and I would almost say credibility, is the fact that people like you are not making up a story that it all hangs together. I mean, is still so peculiar and so mysterious that here's a case, as you say, of no UFO, no abduction. It's a ghost story.
Yeah.
And John Mack, later in his life, I think, realized that a lot of these anomalous experiences seem related. I mean, he first thought that alien encounters was something apart and very real. They were happening in, recognizable reality. He began to doubt that, because clearly they're not happening in a reality that we non-experiencers can recognize, and they're not documented. So it's happening in some other, liminal realm.
Yeah.
But it does seem to be related to other anomalous experiences. He got very interested in survival of consciousness and life after death and crop circles, other things that are also unexplainable the way we understand, reality today. But that's a fascinating story, Jay. it does argue for expanding our definition of what's quote real, or what quote happens, and there is no answer. This is, I guess, what I came away with, that no one's explaining this. All we can do is document it and say this is a phenomenon that seems real, certainly to the people who experienced it. There is some evidence, fragmentary evidence, that it happened, but It's a genuine mystery, and I wish the skeptics would tune into that and not be so quick to explain it away or ridicule it.
I know. I mean, you know, on a whole, we're all just too easily convinced that reality is the baseline operational thing that we see on a day-to-day basis, and that's it. There's nothing else. There's nothing truly mysterious. But, you know, boy, was I proven wrong, and so have so many other people who have had these types of experiences. And, you know, anyone who really does their due diligence and pays attention to what's being said by people like John Mack, you know, it's just it is frustrating. And speaking of skeptics, how has your book been received by peers in journalism? Do you feel that it's been overall supportive, or are you having to justify your reasons?
Very, very much so. I mean, I have not gotten any pushback. I think I was careful in couching my work as you know, the investigations that I did, that John did, John Mack, that these are accounts of experiences that by their very nature are impossible to prove, you know, scientifically at this point, definitively. And yet, you know, John argued for the value of witnessing. He said we are left really with a phenomenon that is based on witness accounts. And, you know, and we credit witness accounts in court. People get convicted and sentenced to death on you know, witness accounts, even without, you know, even with only circumstantial evidence. So we accept it there. But of course, there's a reluctance to accept, you know, one person's account, an anecdotal account, without any, you know, really powerful corroborating evidence, especially when the claims are so phenomenally weird. So I think
that's the key, isn't it? It's the fact that this is such an absurd issue to deal with. I think people just have a psychological rejection to it sometimes, you know.
And the stories get wilder and wilder. I mean, the accounts, that's another thing that impressed John Mack, is that while there was a basic consistent narrative, general narrative of people who spot some kind of a craft, they spot alien beings, they are transported through walls or windows, solid, you know, walls to some kind of a craft, and then they're subject to certain pseudo-medical experiments, sometimes the taking of eggs from women and sperm from men for the apparent production of a hybrid race, which they are re-abducted later to, you know, to visit. These stories come up again and again, but the details are so different and singular and so intense and particular. You have to feel it's who would make this up? I mean, it's just impossible, the level of detail, the strangeness. So that's a mark of this phenomenon, that the stories are infinitely varied and almost too strange to imagine.
You know, it's funny. I mean, like you were saying before about this being a singular phenomenon or an overarching phenomena, like, you know, people like Jacques Vallée also, I think, ascribe to that idea that it could be, you know, some overarching phenomena that's expressing itself in a lot of different ways. And these are being interpreted as different paranormal experiences. And, you know, if you invoke one extra dimension, then all of these things suddenly become answered. You know, we have to invoke that extra dimension. But if that is what we're dealing with, then it would make a lot of these different experiences make more sense if there was another reality, another level, right, another frequency of reality that's kind of interpenetrating with our own, that would, you know, explain a lot of this. So perhaps, you know, through quantum physics and modern advanced physics, we'll figure out that there's some rift between us and another realm that's kind of, you know, leaking into each other. But at the moment, it just remains this profound mystery. And are you optimistic about the mainstream media eventually addressing these kind of issues like experiences and abductions? Because I mean, right now, we're still, although it is getting better, we are still teetering between the kind of Russian, Chinese, foreign adversaries explanation for UFOs. Could it not be? Whilst trying not to mention the words alien or extraterrestrial, you know, it's very controversial to go into that realm still. So, you know, this is all being discussed in quite a delicate manner right now. Do you think that there's room for a mainstream discussion about experiences?
Let's look at the UAP report that came out June 25th from the Director of National Intelligence. A lot of people were waiting very eagerly for that report, and many people were disappointed. This was the report mandated by Congress that the Pentagon basically had to submit with as part of the appropriations bill within 6 months. So they came out with the report. It was only 12 pages. It was short, but there were some really interesting things in it. It said, first of all, that the phenomenon is real, is physically real. These things exist. These UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, we used to be called UFOs. Pentagon doesn't like that term. I guess it's too woo-woo. They don't call them flying saucers anymore. Maybe that's a good thing. Whatever it is, they physically exist. So they don't know where they come from, whether they're intelligent, why they're here, how they traverse these amazing distances, whatever. But they exist, and they are a potential threat to our aviation. So that's a big breakthrough, I think, that because, as you know, for years, the Pentagon was insisting that these things were mental aberrations, they were myths, they were fly specks on the windshield, they were the planet Venus, and misobserved, like, you know, people don't know the difference between a craft with windows, you know, and the planet Venus. But anyway, and now they're saying, no, these things, you know, it's something real. So you ask if I'm optimistic. Yeah, I mean, the government is catching up with what a lot of people have been saying for many years. So I think that's encouraging. Then now, as I pointed out in the article I just did for the Debrief website, they're not saying anything about alien origins or extraterrestrial, you know, connection, because they don't know. Clearly, they don't know.
Do you believe that, or do you think that they maybe do know? Someone does know.
Well, they know more than they're saying. It's clear. Yeah. I mean, we put out three videos in the New York Times, and those are only fragments of longer videos. So there's many more videos and longer segments of videos. Oh, the government definitely know. I mean, look, that the June 25th report was for public consumption, 12 pages, but there was a classified annex given to congressional committees. We don't know what that said. So they definitely know more than they're saying. I think that's clear. How much more they know, or whether the government has in its possession, as, you know, is often whispered or, you know, proclaimed on the internet, the government has in its possession retrieved craft or pieces of craft, or entire flying saucers, you know, that are hidden away in hangars. I don't know that. That's whatever the government has been able to retrieve, if anything at all, is classified.
I mean, I definitely think it's interesting that you've had people. I mean, you know, you've spoken to him yourself, so you would know Eric Davis, you know, talking about craft retrievals. There's no getting around that. He briefed congressional staffers on
right. We reported that in the Times, and that, again, I'm very proud of that story. It was a very carefully written and reported story that said that Eric Davis and some others briefed congressional staff on reported retrievals of material from crashed UFOs. Now, we didn't say that the government has these materials. We said that Eric Davis showed slides, one of which we showed in the New York Times, citing the possibility of materials obtained from crashed UFOs, from off-planet vehicles, I think was the kind of the phrase, off-planet vehicles. Now, if congressional staff were briefed on that, that's interesting. That takes it up a level. It shows that some people, like Eric Davis, were comfortable enough sharing this information with certain people in our government. Now, we don't know beyond that, you know, what's there. And as I said, this is classified territory, and you can't get, access to this information at this point. Maybe in the future we will know more, but there's a lot of stuff floating around the internet, but we've been meticulous in the New York Times to stick with stuff we can back up with, you know, by sourcing it to a real person, not just an informed source says. So when you require people to speak on the record, it's much more difficult. You get a lot less, but at least the information is worth more. So.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing, especially when if you've been given off record statements that would be very beneficial on record, but they are reluctant to step into that terrain and do that for the obvious risks. Obviously, as you're saying, classified territory, national security, the breaking of NDAs. You're talking about very serious territory here with real consequences to these people. So I understand it. And I think everyone else really deep down does understand it, but we all have this niggling suspicion, probably more than a suspicion for some people, that there are these monumentally important things being hidden away from us, not just on the experience side, but as we've just drifted into this material science discussion. And it's a shame that we have to be in that kind of position with stuff like this, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, some of it is national security related. We're obviously in competition with earthly adversaries like Russia and China, who, by the way, seem to be just as mystified as we are. And they may be doing even more research because they don't need to, get permission from their people. They're, more authoritarian, so they can do things without having to explain them to voters. That basically debunks the idea that, what we're seeing up there or underwater, sometimes they're underwater, emerging from and entering the ocean, that these could be secret Russian or Chinese or other foreign technology or our own secret, weapons. But we have pretty much discounted that because, first of all, the U.S., wouldn't be flying UAP or UFOs in airspace where it could collide with our own pilots. It would be a terrible scandal if that ever came out. And there have been close near misses. And we don't think, the government, the people we've talked to, don't think that any country on Earth has developed its technology to the point where they could be, fielding these hypersonic things with no visible propulsion that can, reach tremendous speeds, appear and disappear at will, go into the water, emerge from the water. I mean, who has that technology? It's pretty unimaginable. The UAP report that came out June 25th. It was interesting. It cited all these possible explanations. It said, well, it could be naturally occurring phenomena like ice crystals, or it could be weather balloons, or it could be Russian or Chinese, or, and then number five, it could be other. That's a big category, other. So they lump it in with other. But other is, of course, the most interesting.
Other is the most interesting. I remember reading that and going, oh, for goodness sake. That's right. All of this. It's all in the other bin. They've just thrown it into the miscellaneous.
Right.
It's a shame. And also just speaking about the whole Russian-Chinese thing, in terms of another reason why that can be pretty much, I mean, not for all, because there could be new developments, but I think in terms of the overarching issue of UFOs, there is a historical context that precedes 2004. Like, it didn't all start in San Diego in 2004. It started many, many years beyond that, maybe even thousands of years beyond that. But we definitely have records of testimonies of similar maneuvers, similar capabilities that go beyond the Wright brothers. So
that's a good point. That's a very good point that if you believe that the Russians and Chinese developed this technology, did they develop it before the Wright brothers? that collapses pretty quickly. But, the government has to say this because it's one of the things you have to tick off, the boxes that you have to, if you're being, you know, properly skeptical or conservative, you have to allow for, is this within the realm of possibility? But then the more you know, you sort of discount that and say, no, that's not really possible.
Yeah. Jumping back to the experiences stuff for a minute, during your investigations into the UFOs, and I'm speaking broadly here in terms of like the last 4 years or so, you know, you've undoubtedly spoken to numerous individuals within the US intelligence and defense communities, people in Congress, people with credible backgrounds. And I'm just wondering if any of them told you that they've had experiences as well. How many people in government have you spoken with who will quietly admit to you that they themselves have had an experience?
That's a good question. Several have. I mean, and again, this is not something that they go on the record with. You know, we're aware of some people who have had experiences that they won't admit publicly or on the record, but will acknowledge privately in discussion. So, you know, one of the things John Mack found is that the group of experiencers does include people from all walks of life, including professionals, law enforcement people, psychiatrists, a broad cross section of people, and that would, of course, would include politicians. And Fife Symington he was the governor of New Mexico, I believe, or Arizona. He famously ridiculed an encounter story. And later admitted that he was wrong to do it. He made a big show of poking fun at it. He had somebody in an alien costume come on stage.
Oh, that was the Phoenix Lights. Yeah,
that was the Phoenix Lights.
Okay. Yeah.
And then later he admitted that he should not have made fun of it. He had reason to believe these encounters were truly mysterious. And but that's how politicians deal with it. Unfortunately, they make fun of it. And the number of people who have experienced this does include people in government and people in high positions. As I say, it's not easy to get them to admit that on the record, but it is a broad cross. Look, Carrie Mullis, and this was in my article in the debrief, and it's in my book, won a Nobel Prize for chemistry, a very famous researcher who invented a way of replicating DNA quickly, millions and billions of times for study. So an authentic Nobel Prize winner shared the Pulitzer Prize for chemistry. And he had an encounter, nothing to do with a UFO. He saw a glowing talking raccoon, he wrote in his book. That said to him, "Good evening, doctor." And the next thing he knew, it was the next morning. He was at someplace different along the road. He didn't know how he got there. And he had a flashlight with him that disappeared, never could find it. And then his daughter called him. This happened in Mendocino, California, and told him of an experience she had, very similar.
What?
So, I mean, you know, used to ask whether, you know, people in government have had he's a Nobel Prize winner, had this experience. So go figure.
That's an interesting one. Because of what he described it to be, that's incredibly strange. I mean,
yeah,
I've never heard of that one.
Well, again,
before.
You know, what's interesting is that these things don't follow a normal storyline. There are, you know, talking raccoons and owls that fly into the car, and then the next thing, the people don't know where they are. They're, you know, missing time. So these stories are very, very strange.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but I do remember listening to a story from a woman. She seemed pretty credible when I was listening to her, but she was talking about childhood experiences where you know, like a pirate ship would come down from the sky. Like she would see it through a bedroom window and there'd be like a glowing pirate ship that would come down, and then she would get on board the pirate ship and then it would turn into a UFO. It would become a spaceship as she entered into it. And other times it would appear like a big glowing Christmas tree, like things that would appeal to a child. And it's, yeah, I can't remember. I remember hearing that, but I can't for the life of me remember who it was that was giving that testimony. But like you said, it seems, and it even ties into things that we can actually apply to evidence that's arisen. So for an example, slide 9 from the ATIP slides that seems to talk about, you know, the ability for cognitive interfaces and for this for the phenomenon to kind of skew our perceptions of cognition and our perceptions of time. And so you've got the ATIP slides that are discussing this kind of issue, and this is how it may be manifesting, is that it can manipulate how you perceive it, how you observe it, and for whatever reason that can manifest as talking raccoons.
Yeah, I mean, animals figure very largely in these stories. People say they were riding along a road at night and they hit a deer. And then the next thing they knew, they, you know, they were on a different road and they reached their destination hours later and they didn't know, you know, what happened, and their watches stopped. And then later in relaxation techniques or so, they recall different parts of that. They were stopped, but, you know, by a strange vehicle, little men took them out. This is very common. And I've heard these stories. And again, the people who tell them seem otherwise normal, eminently sane, lucid in every other respect. So I've talked to these experiencers myself, and they are otherwise perfectly normal. But they've had these experiences which they don't understand, and they're not looking for attention. On the contrary, they flee from it. They're afraid that people will dismiss them as, you know, insane, and they know it themselves. I just, you know, in this article I wrote in the Debrief, people say when we talk like this, people think we're insane. So they're the first ones who realize that, and that's why they're so reluctant. They meet in support groups, and they share their experiences with each other, but they're very reluctant to come forward.
So yeah. Again,
the debunkers who say, oh yeah, they're looking for, you know, publicity, couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah. I've been, because anyone who's listened to me for long enough will have probably heard about the experiences that I've had, but I'm lucky that my family listened and respected it. And there were some issues, like, I won't name any names, but there were some issues where I was like, oh, well, maybe, you know, you need to get your head checked. But as especially because I've progressed with what I'm doing now, and I'm talking to people like yourself and doing this kind of thing, and have kind of displayed that I have not lost my mind. I've been fortunate that my family really respects that I've had these experiences, and my friends respect that. And you know, it's mainly people just online that cast their doubts on it, and I don't care, because I know what I saw, and it modeled what I do now. And it's a profound experience. And I, you know, for me, what I saw was amazing. I won't go into extreme detail, but I saw orange orbs of light hovering above my house, and they came down from the sky. These were not lanterns. These were very much slightly translucent orange orbs of light. And you know, that was enough for me. And I guess perhaps it wasn't so outrageous as a UFO experience of abduction and in experimentation, so maybe it was easier to digest for my family members, because it's incredible, but it's not that type of experience. And so I've always kind of had to look at those experiences where people have very, very detailed, like you were saying, incredibly detailed experiences, and I just wonder, like, wow, what is all of that about? And, you know, why this difference in how they interact, sometimes relatively subtle, sometimes what would seem to be dragging you out of your bed in the middle of the night. I mean, That kind of makes me think we're dealing with different things here, that there are different behaviors at play.
Well, that may also be true. I mean, the people who had these experiences speak of many different kinds of beings. And this then gets, as one guy told me for my Debrief article, he says, now you're really diving into the deep end of the swimming pool. But there are stories of different races, alien races and beings, and, you know, reptilians and warlike beings and doctor figures that seem to be in charge, and the robotic grays that predominate may be robots in some thinking. Because they seem to react in a very robotic way and not be the ones in charge. So, you know, what made me think a little bit about your experience with the orbs, that that things that are seen as one thing have a way of turning into something else. So people, you know, sometimes see something and then in regression, you know, procedures, hypnosis or whatever, then they realize that what they saw really turned into something else. So,
yeah, I've thought about that, that, you know, it could be even my own psychological reaction to something so adverse, something so drastic and different, that perhaps I imprinted something acceptable onto it. And that's the form of these. Or I have thought about that. And funnily enough, something that occurred with me the day after, because I don't want to go too deep into this because it's like a whole long thing, and we can do that at some point, maybe even if you want to go into it. But because my experiences did actually come from what is quite a controversial idea of initiating contact through meditative techniques. I got into a very, very calm state of mind, and I very coherently modeled my intentions on making contact. And I, you know, this is, the experiencer is a controversial thing. The contactor is like an even more controversial thing. Yes. And it comes with some, you know, explanatory baggage that is a long story for why I was actually in my garden doing that kind of thing. But I was, and I did actually have success, because on four separate occasions, I saw these orange orbs of light in different formations on four separate occasions within the space of a month in August in 2019. And the first time I saw these orbs, the next day I woke up and I got out of the shower, and people have heard this and I've got the photos as well. I got out of the shower and I went to dry off my arm, and I immediately saw three very, very bright red, almost like cigarette burns, dots in a triangle formation. So it was like one there, one there, and one there in a triangle. They have faded now, but they were there on my arm, and I've got the photos. They were there on my arm for well over a year. They're still very slightly visible, but basically what freaked me out about these is that when I saw them, there was no scab, there was no bump, there was no bruise, there was no inflammation, no skin trauma. I couldn't feel them. They just looked like scarred over skin. It looked like an old wound that had scarred over. There were three of these dots. I'll send you photos, Ralph, because I'm sure you'd love to see this. And I try to dismiss it. I don't know if it was completely 100% tied to that, but it's very strange, and I couldn't think of a rational explanation for them, because they stayed on my arm for so long. I mean,
you know, there's this red grid mark phenomenon.
Yeah,
you're aware of that, but people have found these on their backs. Usually, it's, you know, when there's a couple, the wife or the husband would notice it because it's on the back. You don't see it, but it's in a pattern of geometric pattern, red dots. And there's actually a website devoted to it where people are talking about this. So it's not uncommon. I mean,
no.
A lot of people have commented on it, and it's not associated. I looked into this a little bit. It's not necessarily associated with an abduction experience or a UFO sighting. It just appears.
Yeah.
And people don't know where it comes from, you know, why, et cetera, what the purpose is or whatever. Anyway, but your experience brings that to mind. And again, you know, there's a lot of room here for scientific investigation. And one of the things I say in my book, The Believer, at the end is science has devoted billions of dollars to various very worthwhile scientific inquiries. For example, 2 years ago, or no, four years ago now, scientists succeeded in getting an image of a black hole 55 million light years away. And you can multiply the zeros to see how far away that 55 million light years, they have an image of a black hole. Now, they were able to get that with different observatories literally around the world, all sending in pieces of a picture. And this was put together, and they have this very compelling image. Also, just a few years ago, they found this elusive particle, the Higgs boson, after billions of collisions underground. And they spent billions and billions of dollars to get this, all worthwhile. Well, spend a tiny portion of that and try to figure out what kind of experiences these people are having, which leave marks. And as I say, which come with fragmentary bits of evidence, like UFO sightings, and why some people have that, other people don't. It's a worthwhile scientific endeavor. And hopefully science will get to the point, where they can look. It's Avi Loeb, in his very fine book on, this object that came into our solar system, Oumuamua, which he argues in the book was not a natural object. It might have been intelligently devised and sent into our solar system. By the time it was detected, it was out again. It passed through. But he also argues for scientific investment. He doesn't like alien abduction because it goes through the human element. And he said, let's just stick to our instruments. Human beings are too complicated to figure out what they perceive. So I get that. But very interesting that he also argues for greater scientific investment.
Yeah, and that's what we need. We need more scientific discourse, discussion on these types of issues. And I think it will come with the development of models, with challenges in, from neuroscience to quantum mechanics. We are, in my opinion, transitioning into new phases of science, which will start to give room for explanations or ideas or hypotheses behind what these types of things are. For me, it's particularly interesting, and I would be interested to know if you've given this any research interest. I understand that, obviously, and I think most people are aware that the idea of contacting the phenomenon is very controversial, with the CE5 thing and Stephen Greer, and people are not a fan of that, and I understand. But this is, for me, people like Greer, all due respect to what he's been doing in the field, they've coined a term and capitalized a method, but this is a mystery of consciousness, the perturbing of the mind, the idea that it may be able to respond and interact externally from just your physical body. This is a real discussion that's been going on for thousands of years, and there are people that have proclaimed to be able to use their minds in amazing ways for thousands of years. So it's a very ancient esoteric question that we're having to face within a modern lens, presented by the UFO phenomenon, because for whatever reason it does seem some aspect of it responds to levels of consciousness that I'm not quite sure what they are, but they seem to involve calming states and very clear intentions and coherent thoughts about what you want to see happen or what you want to occur. This is how it happened for me. So I'm just wondering, have you given that much thought within your journey of the experiencer?
Yeah, I mean, I've given it some thought. I tell the story in my book of two meetings that John Mack had with the Dalai Lama. And, these were secret, by the way. It was never publicized. John Mack kept transcripts of the sessions and his discussion, like the back and forth with the Dalai Lama, who is obviously no stranger to spiritual, experiences. And it didn't seem strange to him, particularly, that people were encountering other intelligences, alien beings, because Buddhist practice allows for a big understanding of the subtle realms and other things that happen not in the reality we recognize, but in other realms, other realities. So I think it's a very rich subject for discussion, and physics keeps learning new things. We don't know everything there is to know. I'm not saying that everything we've learned so far it has to be thrown out. On the contrary, we just have to continue expanding our understanding of what physics is showing us about the universe. We don't understand how things influence each other while widely separated, or how people can get flashes of insight into things that are going to happen, let's say, or remote viewing where they can see things you know, thousands of miles away and get a clear picture in their mind of something that is far away. All this is in its infancy, this science, but it certainly intrigued the CIA, which funded this research for a long time. There's a lot out there to investigate.
Oh yeah, there is. I mean, that was actually one of the original things I stumbled across when I was first dipping my toes into research, was the CIA's remote viewing programs and all of that. And it sent me down all these, you know, interesting rabbit holes of the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences and all these interesting groups that were involved in this. And, you know, it something that Lou Elizondo said, or at least he was quoted to have said via, oh my God, I've forgotten his name. The CIA guy in To the Stars Academy.
Oh,
Jim Semivan.
Jim Semivan, yeah.
Yeah, when Jim Semivan was doing a book signing, I think it was for, you know, one of the books they were putting out through TTSA. And he said, you know, I was speaking to my friend Lou, and Lou says that he thinks we'll find the truth to this subject within the nexus of consciousness and quantum mechanics. And I think that's exactly how I feel, that there is this core which involves both of these things, the what some people may call the spiritual and then the scientific, the physical and the non-physical, the quantum and the conscious. It seems like this conversation of UFOs interpenetrates with both of these conversations, and I find that really interesting, just based on my own outlook on life. And it almost seems as if we, at one point in very distant archaic history, we were a shamanic, you know, quite psychedelic species of tribal groups, and that was the way we went. And then we went into technology, and we went into, you know, reductionist science and materialism. And it feels to me as if the UFO phenomenon almost represents a melding between these two things, between the shamanic, spiritual, psychedelic, transcendental, and the material science, quantum mechanics, propulsion, energy. It seems to exist within both of these realms, and makes me wonder, are we due a transition from shamanic to technological to techno-shamanic, you know, techno-spiritual or something like that? It gives me some level of optimism.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. You know, some of the experiencers say that in their interactions with alien beings and their astral travels, so they encountered these beings who said that the UFOs are mentally controlled by them, that their physicality somehow depends on how they're conjured up in the minds of these beings. That's sort of what you're saying, that there's a mixture of spiritual and technological that comes together somehow. And you know, I mean, again, the revelations in the UAP report that these things exist physically are really quite striking, that now we know from the government itself that these things have left a signature in reality. They have a physicality. So they exist. They're not just some spiritual construct or archetype. So now that we know that they exist physically, we can try to pursue some of the other questions, yeah. Like, you know, well, where are they coming from? Who designed them? Why are they here? It's a beginning. It's a very small beginning, because it leaves open all the other questions. As a matter of fact, it makes the other questions more urgent. If they physically exist, well, how the hell do they get here? Who designed them? Why are they coming here? What's the purpose? Which, of course, those questions remain completely unanswered and mysterious.
And they need to be developed upon, which I think they will. I hope they will. I do worry sometimes that the way in which this is being handled now, with the idea of there being generated reports over time, that it's just maybe going to lose its sexiness to the media, you know, in terms of, you know, UFOs and flying saucers, if it just becomes bureaucratic reports about UAP encounters. Will the momentum increase from that? Do you think that there's potential?
I think that the more we know, the more interesting it becomes. And yeah, you know, Carl Jung was disappointed to find that these things, well, I mean, he didn't know at that point that they physically exist. This is, he wrote about this in the 30s. So he said, but he said at one point, it's disappointing, or would be disappointing, to think that these things are real after all. So, but I don't think we have to take that as a setback. I think, on the contrary, it's very exciting to think that, you know, these things have some kind of reality. And therefore it raises all the other questions. You know, it's not just something spiritual, but,
Well, I think it would really blow our minds if it was a physical psychic object. That would challenge all conventions we understand. It's a physical object, but it was created through mental phenomena of some.
Well, we know that the mind. I mean, this brings up the whole, you know, all the research into psychokinesis, and so can you move objects with your mind? Can you kill people by thinking about them? You know, what powers does the mind have? Can the mind cure the body? Things like that. But I think we are in the infancy of understanding the powers of the mind. And as you know, science keeps finding that consciousness is more than the functions of the brain. I mean, the afterlife experiences that people have reported suggest that when the brain shuts down, consciousness continues in some way from the life after death research, you know, survival of consciousness, which is what John Mack was involved in at the end of his life. He was very interested in that because Elizabeth Targ, the daughter of Russell Targ, the remote viewing pioneer, she died early of brain cancer. A very sad story, a friend of John Mack's. And there were stories that her spirit sent signals after she died that her family and friends received. And John was working on a book about her and her family, the power of a realm of love, sort of the way he phrased it. And he himself, as I say at the end of my book, appeared, or his spirit appeared to people after he died, or so they told me, and I put it in the book at the end of the book, so as not to, you know, to position it, let's say, as one of the less well-confirmed aspects of the story. And yet it's there that people said John Mack appeared to them afterwards and they got signals from him and he was studying survival of consciousness and here he is. So, you know, who knows, but that would seem to add some speculation or whatever you want to call it on the ability of the mind to transcend physical death. And, you know, those are the big mysteries still out there. Are we alone in the universe? And what happens after we die?
These are the
those
ones.
Are the two big ones.
These are the big ones. These are the big ones. Absolutely. Couple of questions before we wrap up. Really enjoying this, by the way, Ralph. It's been brilliant conversation so far. I want to kind of segue just real quick. There's been a lot of discussion recently within the UFO community. It seems to rise and fall, this conversation, but this sudden uptick in discussion about the Admiral Wilson leaks. And many people, myself included, and the majority of my colleagues believe these notes are real. The notes that took place between Dr. Eric Davis and Admiral Thomas Wilson. Do you think the Admiral Wilson documents are legit? Do you think they're a complex hoax? Where do you sit?
I just don't want to pronounce on that. I'm aware of what you're talking about. I know Admiral Wilson has denied it. Eric Davis doesn't go on the record about it. The documents are, you know, on the internet. Everybody can read them, but without people coming forward to confirm, you know, these things, it's just not at a point where it can be, resolved one way or the other. So I would just leave that alone for now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to agree with you. It causes a lot of division within the community about whether or not it's real. And, the thing is, a lot of people have had to walk a fine line because they're aware of off-record comments. And, there are researchers who have had off-record comments from some of the people, key players involved. I wouldn't ask you to name names, but have you had any off-record comments given to you by people who are close to this story?
You know, I don't want to talk about that, Jay.
All right.
once it's off the record, first of all, it's off the record. Secondly, I'm so proud of the fact that the stories we got into the New York Times and the stuff I got into the Debrief article was all on the record. Those experiencers, you know, it's too easy to take the stories of experiencers and say, and by the way, John Mack, in his 13 case studies in his first book, Abduction, changed their names. He wanted to protect them. So they're not under their real names. Now, later, some of them came forward and identified themselves and said, this is me in the book. And I, you know, and that gave their stories much more credibility. So I'm proud of the fact that the four stories I tell in the Debrief article all have the name of the person attached to it. And that gives them more credibility. So when you start to talk about what people say when they're not on the record and they can't stand behind it or they can't, you know, attach their names to it, that really reduces the value in my book. And it's too easy to, you know, to quote people anonymously, and it just creates doubt as to, you know, the veracity of what they're saying. You can't ever check it out because you don't know who really said it. So my training as a New York Times reporter really has helped me with the John Mack book, with the Debrief article, with other stuff I've written, because I don't like to rely on unnamed sources.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's a fantastic thing that you're jumping into that territory. I mean, because for me, it seems like there are two big discussions that are not occurring to a satisfactory level, and that is the crash retrieval aspect, which is why I had to throw in those cheeky questions. I'm sorry, Ralph. I just have to do it. And the experiencer aspect. These are the two parts that really need to be looked at, because there's this physical component where we may have evidence of materials, and there's also this experiencer component that just opens up so many doors as to what is going on. So I appreciate that you're drilling down on that, and I do hope that you get more, because I mean, one of the reasons why you had to, and no disrespect to the Debrief, because the Debrief are fantastic and I love Tim McMillan and the guys over at the Debrief, but you did originally pose this for the New York Times, right? And the New York Times decided not to.
And as I, you know, I have explained, it was an experiment by various editors and photography editors at the Times that we tried to make work. What happened is the editor left the Times, the photography editors, one left and one moved to a new job. And the people who are most passionate about that story weren't there anymore to champion it. So other people came along and they weren't as enthusiastic about it. It happens, you know, in my business, I've had stories that didn't work out in the New York Times for various reasons. It's a call that editors make, that this is a story we want to run, this is not a story we want to run. So in the end, they decided, the people who wanted that story and backed it and pushed for it left. So I didn't have the same champions there anymore. And other people had a slightly different take on it, not as enthusiastic. So it didn't work out. As I say, nothing nefarious there. It happens all the time. They make calls on what they want to run and what they don't want to run. So I was free to take the story elsewhere, which I did. End of story. You know, no hard feelings. I've written a lot. I spent 45 years at the New York Times. I hope to write many more stories for the New York Times as a contributor. I've written stories since then for the Times, most recently just a few weeks ago on 9/11. So I have a good relationship with the Times. I don't hold them anything against them for, you know, going back and forth on different proposed stories. So that's it.
But that's important, right? Because that alone, I mean, you know, I can understand why they wouldn't maybe want to go with this right now. But that alone, the fact that you're able to still obviously contribute to the New York Times, you're still respected as a journalist, even though you're deciding to talk about these issues, that alone is a really good step forward, in my opinion. I don't know if you could have done that a few years ago, if you suddenly decided to start pitching stories about abductions or experiences. I think that the time period we're in now seems to be the opportunity to do that.
You know what I found out about the New York Times years ago, Jay, that you can discuss anything in the New York Times if you approach it right. And early in my career at the Times, a book called Human Sexual Response burst on the scene. It was Masters and Johnson, you know, the same people who were behind that Netflix series late. I think it was Netflix, that TV series. And it was very pioneering research about sexuality and very explicit. So the book came out. The Times did a huge number on that book in terms of explaining what Masters and Johnson was saying about human sexuality, the physiology of human sexuality in great clinical detail in the New York Times. And what I learned from that is you can write about sex in the New York Times and sexuality and physical sex if it's done in the proper way. In other words, it's not lurid, it's not leering, it's not, pornographic. It's there as a scientific, approach, however you want to call it. So, and they've done that with many other things that was seemingly controversial, that were controversial, and yet they approached it in a sensible, serious way. And they said, this is part of the human experience. Let's look into it. So we did our UFO stories. We'll do other stories, and it'll get done.
Well, yeah, it will get done pace by pace, bit by bit. And with the efforts like yourself, writing these books, doing these articles, and everyone else out in there, including, researchers like myself and like all my other colleagues who are out there trying to do this, we will push forward. And, I don't know about you, but I look at the structures of our world, whether they be social, political, financial, scientific, philosophical, and it would seem to me that the status quo across the board in all of these sectors is being placed under pressure. A few notable examples could be the potential disruption to centralized financial systems via cryptocurrencies, the dissolution of trust in governments and political systems over the past few years, the challenges being faced in modern medicine and neuroscience by the introduction of psychoactive psychedelic research. That's a very interesting emergence within the Western scientific arena. And then, of course, modern physics and material science being challenged by the UFO issue. So it really does feel as if the majority of our institutional strongholds, our models for what reality is, are being placed under a lot of pressure and a need to transform in order to make space.
That's happened many times in human history.
Absolutely. But that's kind of my point, is that we seem to be approaching a transition phase. And I have a strong feeling that there are a lot of the reason why we're being put under these types of pressures is because this is what happens in history when we go forward as a civilization. So I was going to just finish this off with, do you feel optimistic? Do you see that there could be some positive changes on the horizon from things like UFOs being addressed and technologies getting better and perhaps even studies into consciousness becoming more refined? Do you think that there's a light on the horizon? Because there's some pretty dark times ahead of us as well.
I am very optimistic. I think that people have been ahead of the government on this issue all along. When the government was saying there's nothing to it, people were saying, no, there is something to it, because I've seen these things. So sometimes the people have to bring the government along. We move toward the light slowly, but we're moving, as Martin Luther King said, in the right trajectory. It's a long arc, but it moves toward justice. And I think we take steps forward, we take steps backward. Politically, the world is in a terrible mess. Nationally, ditto. But I think we're learning a lot. We're benefiting from our experience, and it's not easy. And, there's still a lot of ridicule around the subject. But when you look back at where we came from, that only a few years ago, they weren't even acknowledging the reality of UFOs, UAP. And now they say, yeah, they exist. So I'm optimistic.
I'm optimistic with you, Ralph. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to sit down and have a talk with me again. It's been a while, but it's always a pleasure, and one to be repeated, I hope, in the future. I would also just like to encourage everyone who's listening to check out Ralph's latest book, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science and the Passion of John Mack. Links will be in the description box below and also pinned to the top of the comment section. Ralph, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jay. A real pleasure to see you again, and we'll do it again.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.